Hello and welcome to another episode of Unleashing the Doctor Within. Today we've got Dr. Chalmers, an orthopedic surgeon, and as always, Bridger Battaglia.
Hey, Dr. Chalmers, thank you for being on the episode with us today. We're really excited to have you. For a quick intro, Dr. Peter Chalmers is a orthopedic surgeon at the University of Utah. He does sports medicine, and he's a mentor of one of our classmates. After we dropped the first couple episodes of the podcast, we had him come up to us and say, I've got somebody that would be the perfect guest for your podcast. He's really, really impressive, and I think a lot of people would benefit from what he has to say. So if you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, first off, thanks for having me here. It's always an honor to be part of something like this and to do whatever I can to help up students coming through. I know that medical school can be challenging. And it can be hard to see the light at the end of the tunnel when you're in the middle of it, especially in the second year when there's not a lot of patient contact and it's just a lot of tests and class and books and questions. So I'm originally from Portland, Oregon, and I went to college back east at Dartmouth and then from there to medical school at Columbia. I took a year in between those two to teach and coach high school. And then
what did you coach?
I coached distance running.
Cool.
At a school called the Punho School in Honolulu.
Nice.
Yeah.
Not a bad place to live.
It was a great place to live for a year. Yeah. It was a good year.
So you're kind of bouncing back and forth, West Coast, East Coast, and then off to Hawaii.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, teaching for a year was like a really critical experience. A lot of medicine is actually being an educator for your patients and obviously for students and residents and fellows. And there's things you can learn being a teacher that it's really hard to learn being a doctor, to be honest.
Yeah, I bet. So what I guess made you want to go do that? Were you planning on using those skills that you learned teaching as a future physician, or what was the driving force to move to Hawaii other than Hawaii?
My wife is also a physician. She's a medical oncologist at Huntsman, and she was kind of a year behind me in the application process. So I needed to fill that year so that we could be synchronized for the couples match. So then I went to Columbia in New York City for 4 years, and from there went to orthopedic surgery residency at Rush in Chicago, which is obviously 5 years long. And then I spent a year doing just shoulder and elbow surgery as a fellowship at Washington University in St. Louis. And then from there I spent 2 or 3 months traveling to visit some kind of famous shoulder and elbow surgeons before settling down here at the University of Utah. Where I've been ever since, just doing shoulder and elbow surgery with kind of a focus on athletes.
Right on. How did you decide to come to the University of Utah?
That's a great question. I have a lot of family here, and I spent a lot of time here growing up. So Salt Lake City had always been kind of on my short list of places. This is a particularly desirable job for me for a couple of reasons. One of the main reasons is because I have great partners. The university, as you know, is a great place to work. It's a particularly nice place to live. There's some things about this particular job that match my interests pretty well. And then the other thing is that, and I don't know if you guys are married, but definitely there's a calculus that comes to selecting location when when you're married, because it has to meet not just your needs, but your wife's needs.
Yeah.
So this is a good job for my wife. And then, in addition, it's kind of equidistant from both of our families so that our families can easily come visit us and see our kids and, that we were, because we're not both from the same place. It wasn't like we were settling next to my wife's family, sitting next to my family.
So how is it being married to another physician and kind of working out the couples match and navigating your career plans together?
It's a challenge. But I think the things that are good about it and the things that are always good about being married to a physician is my wife has a good understanding for what I do. And if I'm going to be home late, why I'm home late, or if I'm, anxious or stressed at home, I can talk to her about what's going on, and she, I think, has an understanding for what that means. If you're not married to a physician, it can be harder to communicate that and harder to get that across, and it can be harder. I've seen other couples that can become a little bit of like a barrier. That's the plus side. The minus side is that we're both obviously really engaged in our work, and so that provides that, there's not one person who's like, home, for instance, with the kids all day long. We both personally believe that in the long run, it's good for our kids to both see that, you can be a man or a woman and be a doctor, and that's a totally great thing to do. And I think that provides good role models for our kids. But it definitely means you have to have full-time childcare.
So one of the things that I think about when I talk to physicians who have physician spouses is you hear how hard it is to find work-life balance, whatever that means, as a physician. Would you say it's more difficult with two physician schedules to balance? Or like you said, do you think it's easier because of the understanding?
I don't know. I've only lived it one way, so it's hard to know.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough.
I think that the whole concept of work-life balance has always been a little bit of a challenge. Because I think that ultimately life is work and work is life. And it's hard to say that the two are somehow separable, separate categories. You know, obviously there are things that you enjoy doing that have no connection to what you do in your work. But I think the people at least the people that have mentored me, the people that have been the happiest, have been the people that have for whom to some degree their work is their hobby, you know, mm-hmm. The people that I think if you don't enjoy what you do, then the work-life balance thing becomes a real issue. I think if you really enjoy your work and you really enjoy your life, then it's, you know, you have embarrassment of riches on both sides of the equation, and it's not so much of a balance as it is just picking the things that you most enjoy doing and then obviously spending time to maintain your relationships with your kids and your wife and your family and your friends and all that.
Yeah, very good point. It sounds like you love your job.
I have a good job, to be honest.
How did you decide to go into orthopedics and further subspecialize in the category that you did?
For me, I had I think like a lot of people, I had mentors that were doing things similar to what I'm doing now, where I saw what they were doing and I thought, God, that person seems pretty happy. I could do that. Along the way, when I was in college, I took a class called the History of Medicine, and there was a joint replacement surgeon at Dartmouth that came to give a lecture on the history of joint replacement. I don't know much you guys know about the history of joint replacement, but essentially, for a long time, arthritis was a crippling, disabling, painful disease that patients just struggled with until they died. It was kind of an awful thing, to be honest. And there were some things people did surgically, and none of them really worked, and they didn't really make the patients any better. And there was this doctor named Sir John Charley, and he was in England. He was kind of in the countryside, and he had all these patients with hip arthritis that had been manual labors. And he thought to himself that he could design a replacement that would work. And he spent like 25 years working on it. And this was a long process. I mean, he designed the first implants like in his garage. Okay. And he like banged them into shape, because he was kind of like had a background in metallurgy. And he researched how to fix them and like worked with a dentist who invented the cement, and he basically used what was at the time dental cement to fix the components. He designed the procedures for how to approach the joint and how to do the procedure. He designed all the instruments. And then once the implant was commercially available, at first, if you wanted to do a hip replacement, the only way you could do it was you had to visit Sir John Charley, and he would teach you how to do the procedure, and he would teach you how to use the instruments, and he would teach you how to size the implants. And that was the only way. If you wanted to use the implants and you contacted the company and said, I want to use these, they would say, the only way you can do it is if you visit this guy who invented it. And it was that way for a long time. And the interesting thing is that his results, if you look at like he has published like 30-year outcomes after total hip arthroplasty, the outcomes we have now are not a ton better than his. Like basically he invented it from the ground up. And I heard this story and I thought to myself, I'm not sure that I can think of another life that I would rather have. Like, I'm not sure that I can think of another person that I can think of who's made a greater single-handed contribution to humanity. Because total hip replacement is, I mean, it's among the three best operations ever invented by mankind. I mean, it's a one-hour operation that literally uncripples people with a pretty low complication rate and, you know, like an 80% 30-year survival rate. I mean, it's hard to, there's maybe cataract surgery is up there. You know, like maybe you could say that appendectomy is you know, like it's a thing that saves people's lives. There's certainly other procedures that are good, but it's a really good one.
Yeah.
That he basically single-handedly invented. And I thought, you know, that's a pretty great thing you could do. That's a pretty great thing that guy did. And if that's the field that he's in and that's how he did it, that's probably it's probably something I'd be interested in. And, you know, then the more I explored it, the more it made sense to me.
Very cool. So once you decided that's what you wanted to go into, what were the next steps you took in order to, I guess, put yourself on the right track?
Well, so I was in college. So I went from there to medical school. And in medical school at Columbia, there's a big orthopedics department there. And I went and I had an advisor and I met with him and I said, you know what, if I want to be an orthopedic surgeon, what do I need to do? And he said, well, you should spend the summer between your first and second years doing research, and you got to get good grades and you got to get good board scores because those things are necessary because it's a competitive field. So I found a guy to do research with who was a pediatric orthopedic surgeon at a place called the Hospital for Special Surgery, which is in New York City on the Upper East Side. And he was another guy that I really connected with that I really liked, who was like very kind to me and taught me a lot about, you know, like in particular, like how he managed his practice and, you know, how he'd chosen to do what he wanted to do. And, you know, like the same thing of how he like kind of balanced his life and, made sure that he was spending enough time with his family. And we did a bunch of research together, which was good. he had a bunch of cool ideas, and we kind of made them happen. And it's hard in the summer to get a lot done. So we ended up, you know, I spent 3 months there, and at the end of the 3 months, we had a bunch of things that were started and none of them finished. And it took me probably another 2.5 years to finish most of them, which is, I think, the way that it just goes in research.
Yeah.
And then during that time, I did the things that the mentor told me I had to do them, and I tried to get really good grades, and I studied my butt off for the boards. And then I did 3 of these things called sub-I's that you may have heard mm-hmm. of, sub-internships. I'm not sure. Are they still called that? They're probably mm-hmm. still called that. Mm-hmm. I did one at Columbia, and then I did one at Mass General, and then another one at HSS. And it was fun. I met a bunch of really famous orthopedic surgeons, and I watched a bunch of people do things that, you know, like they were world famous for doing, and it was cool. It was like a really great 3 months. I worked hard, but I met a bunch of people and had a really good time. And then I went on the interview trail and found the residency program that was the best fit for me was not one that I'd happen to do a sub-I at, and that happens all the time too. But yeah.
Well, what was it about Rush that made you really interested in joining their program as opposed to one of the 3 programs you just listed? And I guess kind of the underlying question is like, well, what should we be looking for in residency programs?
It's probably the for surgical training, it may be you look for different things than you look for if you were going to go into a medical specialty. For surgical training, for me, there are really 4 factors that can be objectively compared between programs that I think are largely determinative of your experience. The first factor is location geographically. It's 5 years, so you got to make sure that wherever you're going to go is someplace that you could be happy. I liked Chicago. I wouldn't want to live there long term, but I think that for 5 years it was a really fun place to live. It's a fun place to live when you're a resident because there's a lot going on. So that's number one is geographic location, and the programs don't move. You know, so that's one thing you can like hang your hat on. The program is not going to shift geographic locations. The second thing is surgical volume, and that's for me that subdivides into asking each resident like by the end of your training how many cases did you do, and what variety of cases were they, and then in addition asking them how often during those cases were you the only trainee scrubbed. So like for instance at Columbia, when I was a medical student there, they had 4 operating rooms and 36 residents, and I thought this is a big problem. You guys don't have enough. You like if you look at the ratio of cases to residents, you have a big problem here. And then at Rush, they had 25 residents and like 36 operating rooms. And I asked the residents who were graduating, how many cases have you done? And they were like, well, we did like over 2,000 cases. And I thought, okay, well, if I'm the only person scrubbed for 2,000 cases, like it's going to be physically difficult for me to not learn how to do these operations.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I think those are really important questions to ask. And those things are also unlikely to change because there's a certain amount of that surgical volume that's determined by referral patterns and determined by the size of the universities. So for instance, even if, you know, 3 or 4 high volume surgeons leave, like those referrals are still likely to come to the university and they'll hire someone else and they still have that operating room to fill. So like those, on the converse, it's hard for universities to increase their surgical volume because you have to build more operating rooms and hire more people and recruit more patients in clinic. And those things take, to be frank, years and years to change. So, so I think that's the second thing for me. The third thing was research volume. And this is an easy thing for you to determine. So when you go interview for residencies, you can literally just PubMed the names of the people who interviewed you and determine how many papers they're publishing. If you go someplace, if for instance, you're interested in research, and I was after this experience in medical school, and you go someplace and you PubMed, you know, you meet, let's say, for instance, I think I'm interested in shoulder because I went to Columbia, and Columbia has this like long history. Columbia basically invented shoulder replacement, and there's this long history there, and I liked it. So then I looked at Rush and I said, okay, I'm going to PubMed the names of the four people to do shoulder surgery there and determine how many papers they're writing per year. When I compared that between institutions, Rush was like head and shoulders above everywhere else. And that's another thing that's hard to change because there are resources set up around how to make research happen. And there's a culture that's set up and there's an interest in the part of the attendings. And that stuff, you know, to change those kind of things, you need to hire new people, or you need to hire new attendings that have different opinions, and you need to collect data, and you need to have statisticians available to analyze the data. And like that stuff takes years to build up. So it's another thing that's unlikely to change in between when you interview and when you graduate from that residency. And then the fourth thing is the hardest one to define, and that's the culture of a place. Each you'll see when you interview places that each place has a different culture. Like our residency program has a different culture than Rush did. And it has a different culture than Columbia did, and has a different culture than HSS and Harvard did. Each of them had their own kind of unique characters. And there's a fit aspect to that, where you have to find a place where you feel like you fit in, or you feel like this is a place where my goals and aspirations are going to match with the goals and aspirations, or the opinions and the overall thought processes that kind of exist here as what we call, what I usually call culture.
So during third year, were there any other specialties that piqued your interest and were competing with ortho, or were you pretty sold on ortho early on?
I thought I was going to be a neurosurgeon. I really liked I still think neurosurgery is really interesting. I actually, I don't know if I should admit this on a podcast, but so this is what happened. I thought I was going to be a neurosurgeon. I did all this. I approached the program director at Columbia and I said, I think I want to be a neurosurgeon. And he said, great. So I gave him my CV and he said, it looks like you'd be a fit for our program. If you do research in my lab for a year, I'll give you a spot, which I don't know that he's allowed to do, but that's what he said, basically. And so I said, okay, so how do I make that happen? And he said, well, you need to apply for a grant. And this is the project I was thinking of. So he gave me the project and I did a bunch of research and I wrote a grant. And I applied for funding for the year and I got the funding. So I'd secured the funding and I emailed him and I said, I got the funding. It was like $40,000 or something to pay for the research for the year. And he was like, great. And then I did my neurosurgery rotation. We had at Columbia, which I don't think you guys do here, but I had like an actual neurosurgery rotation during third year, where for 2 weeks I was on the neurosurgery service. And it was miserable. I hated it. and I was like, and I loved the residents. I was like, I fit in great with you guys. I love you guys seem like great residents. And I like the attendings, and the procedures were not particularly interesting. And, the patients didn't get better and the floor work was awful and the clinic was awful. And I thought I would be miserable doing this. And it doesn't really matter if I like you guys or if I like, the brain. I'm like, this is not. It was like a stark realization, like I'm never going to want to do this. So then I went back to the guy that I got the funding for, and he was understandably a little upset. And I told him, you know, like I'm not really sure that I don't think I want to be a neurosurgeon. You know, like I don't think it's a good fit for me. Like I didn't really have a very good rotation. And he's like, well, what else are you going to do? And I was like, I'm going to be an orthopedic surgeon. He's like, you're going to regret it. You're going to be bored. He's like, it's, you know, you'll see, like at first it's hard. And then once you figure it out, you're going to come back. You'll be back. That's what he told me. He said, you're going to come back to this office and you're going to tell me that you made a big mistake. And, I haven't decided that yet. I don't think I'm going to decide that, but, who knows, maybe he's not even there anymore. But, so yeah, so that was the other thing I thought about. And I thought about a little bit about, ENT, which was also a really cool specialty. I liked the people in urology, but I didn't like the procedures as much as I thought I would. My father's an ophthalmologist, and I thought a little bit about ophthalmology, but I'm just not as good of a fit with that specialty as I was with orthopedics. So I don't know, I thought about punishment and things.
Cool. Yeah. I think we have these ideas coming into medical school, right? Like college athlete. Okay. You're going to be ortho, or, oh, your dad was an ophthalmologist, so just keep running with the family business. I think it's really hard for kids to come in open-minded and stay open-minded, right? I think in medicine, there tends to be a lot of pigeonholing, getting people into a corner and saying, this is where you fit. This is your personality. This is who you should hang out with. This is who you should meet. What are some things that you think made the biggest difference for you once you actually knew what you were going to do? Did that help you focus your efforts a little bit more, or were you always just motivated to make sure that you had every possible option?
I think there's an ugly truth here, which is that having better grades and having better board scores gives you more options. It's not as it should be, you know, like it shouldn't be that way, but it is. And I can't change it, neither can you guys, unfortunately. So I think that, it's not quite that simple, but having looked at it a little bit from the other end here now, there's so many applicants that want to do orthopedics that, it somewhat is that simple, unfortunately, which really sucks. Because it's not really, it doesn't, as you guys know, and as you've heard, it doesn't, like, being good at taking tests doesn't necessarily make you a good doctor. In fact, it may make you a bad doctor, because it leads you to want to spend a lot of time alone, mm-hmm. sitting in a room, being right. And those things don't make you very good at clinic, because the clinic is not about sitting in a room alone being right. It's about, you know, like really getting to know your patients and determining what's important to them, which may or may not be right in your opinion. So I don't know. I mean, we have a real problem in medicine because that process starts early. When I say early, like it starts like in elementary school, that the people that don't, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Don't play nice with others on the playground. Probably.
Right.
Yeah. Shouldn't be heading into healthcare.
And that probably makes our doctors overall less empathetic than they would be.
Yeah.
And that's a real issue. Because I think that empathy is super important. And I think that people who have that are better at their jobs and enjoy their jobs more, and their patients do better. So I don't know how we get around that, but it's because it's going to require like a massive shift on our whole educational system.
Yeah, huge change.
Yeah. And it's not just like just fixing the residency issue. That's like one piece of a much larger puzzle.
So what are some things that you, looking back, would recommend to either yourself, or what would you say right now to other students to develop, to do? Like, what experiences would you recommend to help people become a good physician rather than just acing the tests?
There's a couple of things that I did that were helpful. One of them is during the year between my first and second years of medical school, I in addition to doing research, I spent a week with my dad. We went to Peru and we did strabismus surgery. Do you guys know what strabismus surgery is? It's like strabismus is a condition where in children the eyes are not aligned. And one of the eyes, like one eye will look straight and the other eye will look to the right, for instance. And that can be fixed surgically. And the way that it's fixed surgically is you take the muscles connected to the eyes and you reorient them so that the eyes will look the same, look straight ahead. That's kind of important because if you do that before a certain age, then the brain can fuse those two images into binocular vision and give you depth perception. It's also important, super important cosmetically, because that's a kind of stigmatized appearance to have. Anyway, so we went to do strabismus surgery in Peru because that's one of the things that my dad does. And he had kind of contacted a person who runs a clinic there, and there were no doctors where we went that could do that. And so like, it's a big deal to be able, it was for a week. We just operated, you know, we just took people with crossed eyes and made them straight. And, the thing that was good about that is number one, having those experiences as a medical student gives you some insight to say, like, am I going to like that's as pure as medicine gets, you know, it's just that experience or like doing something like that gives you the purest distillation of medicine, where you go someplace where there's people who have a problem. you determine that that problem can be fixed for them, and then you go fix it, and then you get to see immediately the results of your actions. And I think it gives you some hope that, because it's harder to see that, I think, oftentimes as a student when you go into the hospital in America, because you see, like, you know, you may see different parts of that process. You may see the diagnosis of the problem. You may see the treatment of the problem. You may see the end result. You never see the same, very rarely do you see the same patient go through that process as a medical student, because you're not on the services for long enough and you're not with the same person for long enough. So I think that gives you a huge amount of confidence boost to, like, I'm doing the right thing. Like, because that's what you'll see as a, that's what you eventually see as an attending, is you see the same patients through the whole process, you know? The other reason why it was useful is because I operated with my dad. That was, for me, a safe environment, you know, where I felt like, okay, like I needed to know for sure that I could do this. You know, I need to know for sure that, like, this is something that I'm going to, like, maybe I'm not going to be perfect at it the first time, but this is something where I can feel confident that with practice, I'll be able to do this operating thing. Because I think that you need to have that confidence to go into, you need to have that confidence before you head into third year. At least, like, I needed it. Maybe not everyone needs it, but for me, that was helpful.
You know, you've been a great mentor to our friend Garrett. And I know, I mean, just from our conversation, it sounds like you've had a lot of good mentors yourself. Can you tell us a little bit about, like, kind of the role you see mentorship playing in medicine and what it means to you now versus what it meant to you as a medical student?
I've been super fortunate to have some great people that have invested in me. Being a mentor is time consuming, time is not something that, you know, most attendings have in abundance. I think mentorship is, like, super, super important. One of the things that I think I would say about it is that at various points I've been assigned mentors. Maybe you guys have had this too, where, like, the medical school assigns you someone who's supposed to mentor you, or, like, I've had that assigned through various organizations throughout the years, like my college and my medical school and my residency. And even here I've been assigned a mentor, and, like, through my professional societies, I've been assigned various mentors. It's hard to, like, build that relationship through an assignment. It's hard to say, like, you know, someone's just going to be assigned as my mentor and that person and I are going to build this artificial construct, you know. I think it's much better for that to happen organically. Like, it's not like Garrett was assigned to me. Garrett approached me and said, you know, like, I'm interested in this. And that I think is, like, the first step, is going to a mentor and saying, hey, I'm really super interested in this thing you've done, or I'm really super interested in this experience you've had that I want to either try and replicate, or I need to understand how you got to where you are, or, you know, I'm trying to do a similar thing. So I think that that's one of the things that's nice about training programs, is you as the student pick the training program. So you come in already saying, I want to be here. Like, I want to do what you guys are doing. I think that's way more important than someone else that's assigned to you. I don't think that means those programs are bad, but I just think that you don't want to rely on that as your only mentorship.
I think the fact that you are so involved in research is interesting to a lot of people. I know I, for one, coming into medical school, didn't have any real interest in research. I love the clinical side of medicine, but I hadn't really considered a lot of, you know, a future career in research and putting out papers and doing all these things. Why did you decide to focus so much on research in your clinical practice?
Let me ask you this. Why did you decide to become a doctor?
I know exactly where you're going with this. This is a perfect setup, because I wanted to help people.
Right, right. Yeah. Okay, so in the clinic, how many people can you help at a time?
One,
right? Let's say you have a resident. You teach that resident. Then you've leveraged yourself, right? So every person that resident helps, eventually you have also incrementally helped.
Yeah.
Let's say you do research and you find something new that helps every person that is touched by that new thing. Then your time is even more leveraged, right?
Absolutely.
Like, if you really want to do the most good with your time, research is by far the most leveraged. Just like if you're investing, you know, you can make more money by borrowing money and investing it, right?
Yeah.
It's also a lot riskier investing, so you shouldn't do that.
But yeah.
but like, for research, there's none of the risk that comes with it, I don't think. So that's the reason why I do it. Because I think that if you really want to help people, that's the reason why I wanted to be a doctor. Because let's be honest, there's easier ways to make a lot of money.
Much easier ways, yeah.
There's also plenty of other ways to feel like you have something that contributes to society, and there's plenty of other ways to do things, something that helps you, helps people. Ultimately, if you weren't helping someone, no one would pay you to do it. But for me, like, I feel like some of the research we've done has changed people's minds, or it's changed my clinical practice, it's changed other people's clinical practices. And that's ultimately why we do it. There are other ways in which we get wrapped up in research. I think we need to be careful about those ways. One of the ways one of the things that happens is if you do enough research, then you can become semi-famous in your own little field. The problem with that is that you're still only famous to a very small number of people, and that fame is short-lived, and ultimately that's kind of an empty, that's like an empty goal. You know what I mean? It doesn't really lead you anywhere.
Yeah.
So that's that. I think people, you have to be careful about that, because I think you get wrapped up, your ego gets wrapped up in your research, and it even creates your own little intellectual conflict of interest where you have your ideas and they're kind of your horses in the race, and you're like, well, if my horse wins, then I'm going to be famous because that was my idea. And then people will be like, well, that was Chalmers' idea. That was Bridger's idea. This is the Bridger concept, you know, and then they name it after you and you're like, oh, I'm such a famous, important person. But I'm serious.
Yeah.
So like, I think that's a trap, to be honest. The other ways in which people get trapped in research is people will do research for the wrong reasons. They'll do research to try and become wealthier, to be frank, by doing research that benefits a certain company and that company pays them. And that's becoming less and less in our field, because it's become way more transparent with the open payments database. But it still happens. It still happens, certainly in my field, where there, for instance, there's an orthopedic surgeon who makes, you know, tens of millions of dollars from a company, and all of his research supports the products of that company. Like, that's a problem. That person is not doing research to help people, you know? Like, that's not the purpose of that research. You can't honestly look at that and say that. So I think if you keep the motives in the right direction, then research is a way that you can really, really help people. And that ultimately is the reason why we come to work in the morning.
Well, Dr. Chalmers, this has been an absolute pleasure. I'm just curious, do you have any parting wisdom or words of advice for second years that are kind of looking to start their clinicals in June?
I would just say keep your head down. It gets better. It gets better every year.
Well, we appreciate that. Thank you so much for your time, and thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks for having me.